Good afternoon. It's Monday, the 21st of October, 2019, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Mike Robinson. Joining me in the studio today, Patrick Henningsen from 21st Century Wire. Welcome to the programme, Patrick.
Great to be with you, Mike.
We're also going to be joined shortly by Diljana Gunjeva, who's joining us from Bulgaria. And we'll be talking about arms trading and so on. There have been some pretty major updates since we covered this story a couple of weeks ago. But we're going to get started with Brexit, I'm afraid, Patrick, because, obviously some developments over the weekend. So Boris lost the vote, as most people will know by now, for a meaningful vote on Saturday. That was the old deal, same as the old deal, it seems. We'll come on to that in a second. But following the vote, Boris made a statement. And in that statement, I think he perhaps gave the game away. So let's have a quick listen to this.
I'm very grateful, Mr. Speaker, I'm very grateful to you. I'm very grateful to the House of Commons staff, everybody who's put themselves out, everybody who's come to give up their time in this debate today. It's been a very important debate, an exceptional moment for our country, an exceptional moment for our Parliament. Alas, the opportunity to have a meaningful vote has effectively been passed up because the meaningful vote has been voided of meaning. But I wish the House to know that I'm not daunted or dismayed by this particular result. And I think it probably became likely once it was obvious that the amendment from my right honourable friend, the member for West Dorset, was going to remain on the order paper. I continue in the very strong belief that the best thing for the UK and for the whole of Europe is for us to leave with this new deal on October the 31st. And to anticipate the questions that are coming from the benches opposite, I will not negotiate a delay with the EU. And neither does the law compel me to do so. I will tell our friends and colleagues in the EU exactly what I have told everyone in the last 88 days that I've served as Prime Minister, that further delay would be bad for this country, bad for our European Union, and bad for democracy.
So, did you spot it? I don't blame you if you didn't. It passed by very quickly, but it was this. He absolutely gave the game away. Further delay would be bad for this country, bad for our European Union, and bad for democracy. I think he is absolutely giving people what is in his mind at the moment. He is still a Remainer, despite everything that's happened in the last 3 years. I think he's given the game away there. Now, of course, the phrase withdrawal agreement, that's slightly misleading as well. As we know, the treaty, it is going to be a treaty that would establish that during the transition, we would be subject, Britain would be subject to EU laws, EU policies. And of course, that's not the spirit of the referendum. It's just like the Great Repeal Bill. Well, that was the EU Withdrawal Act 2018 that repealed one Act of Parliament and put all of the EU's legislation onto the British statute books. At the time, that was sort of called the Great Repeal Bill, but it didn't repeal anything. So this means, as I say, that during the transition period, assuming Boris's deal goes through this week, that we will be continue to be subject to EU laws on everything, trade, state aid, competition policy, agriculture, fisheries, the works. So during that transition, we will be subject to all the new policies, which is why, of course, Britain has said, for example, that we will implement the EU's copyright directive, which, of course, has got a pretty chilling effect on free speech and pretty much every other directive that's going to come through. That treaty, the Withdrawal Act that he's going to bring in, the 2019 Withdrawal Act that he's going to bring in this week, that will tie us in to everything that we've just talked about. But of course, that leads after the transition period to the future relationship. That's sort of the framework for that is the political declaration on the future relationship, one or more new treaties that we will be subject to. This is not in the spirit of...
But that's not what Labour is protesting in this bill. That's not what the rebels, the Tory rebels, are protesting, those parts of what you just mentioned, which are there, but that's not what they're raising Cain over. They're, they've identified a bunch of other unlabor-like provisions in this bill. They're talking about America being able to raid the NHS, various privatization fears, removing workers' protections, and so forth. So this is the argument that's happening on the surface.
Well, that argument, of course, is on the basis of them having not yet seen the contents of the bill because it hasn't been published yet. So there's a certain amount of speculation and fear-mongering going on over that. But nonetheless, well, we'll come on to this in a second. So, of course, one of the things that happened on Saturday was that Boris was reminded that he was required to write to the European Council, to ask for an extension. And as you just saw in that little clip there, he said that he would not do that. Well, he did and he didn't do it. He wrote the letter, but he didn't sign the letter. And then he wrote a couple of other letters, including this one. And the main thrust of this particular letter was that a further extension would damage the interests of the UK. And the EU went on to say, and of course, this letter he did sign. So he didn't sign the letter, which allows him to pretend that he has fulfilled the requirements of the Benn Act, the act which required him to send that letter in the first place. But he has signed another letter saying that he doesn't want an extension. And of course, he says quite clearly in that third letter that. He has said all along that he doesn't want an extension, so the chances are he isn't going to get one. But as we just mentioned, later on today, allegedly the withdrawal agreement bill, WAB, will be published later today. This was the Bruges Group tweeting this out earlier. We will then know how the government's deal will be implemented in practice and in law. It will be revealing. Now, anybody from Northern Ireland knows what a WAB is. I'm not going to explain that on the programme. You can look it up on Google. Bearing in mind that it is the Northern Irish border which has caused all this furore in the first place, perhaps that's quite an appropriate acronym. But anyway, you know, as for the Tory rebels and the ERG, well, here is the chairman of the ERG, Steve Baker, who right up to this point has been absolutely against Theresa May's deal, and so far mostly against Boris Johnson's deal, which is the same deal, of course. He was on the Today programme this morning saying vast areas of that withdrawal agreement are unchanged, and we're going to have to choke down our pride and vote on the national interest. So the ERG seems to have abandoned what their previous view of the national interest was in favour of a new view of the national interest. Now it's in the national interest to go ahead with a withdrawal agreement, which they were absolutely against up until this point in time. All of a sudden, Steve Baker and the rest of the ERG group, absolutely not talking defence. That is now back off the table. We don't want to mention that at the moment. And of course, the other thing that has been going on in the background is that the one significant change, the consent change with respect to the backstop. The elephant in the room, of course, was the Northern Ireland Assembly has not sat in 2 years. The Northern Ireland Assembly has the final say on whether or not that backstop continues and Northern Ireland stays in this new customs arrangement with the EU, or whether Northern Ireland leaves that new customs arrangement with the EU. The elephant in the room was that the Assembly couldn't possibly make that decision because it hasn't sat for 2 years and no prospect of it sitting again at any point in the near future. Well, in fact, it is sitting today, but because of, as a result of some shenanigans, because what's basically happened is that the Assembly was recalled as a result of a petition by the DUP over whether or not Northern Ireland would liberalise its abortion laws. So they're there to sit on that particular issue alone. It's pretty much not clear whether Sinn Féin will take part in that, but the Alliance Party certainly will not take part in that. In this, the Alliance Party have said they won't attend. This is Paula Bradshaw tweeting this out earlier today. We want nothing more than to be able to see, or sorry, this was yesterday, nothing more than to be able to see the restoration of a fully functioning assembly where all devolved matters could be addressed and that this legislative body is sustainable and not subject to the stop-start fiasco that has plagued it since its re-establishment under the Good Friday Agreement. Now, just to remind everybody, of course, the reason the Northern Ireland Assembly has not been sitting for 2 years is because the DUP was involved in this, or had instigated this green energy scheme, which turned out to be a complete scam in the sense that people were able to heat empty sheds in their fields and claim back more money than it was costing in electricity. And so this was why Sinn Féin walked out of the Northern Ireland Assembly 2 years ago, because the DUP wouldn't take any responsibility for that fiasco, as Paula Bradshaw calls it. And the DUP then playing more games today. So I do wonder what agreements have been made with Boris Johnson, whether this is some attempt to get the Northern Ireland Assembly up and running again, or at least be able to claim that it's up and running again. But we've got to remember that all the attempts to get it up and running again have been pretty much stopped by the DUP over the last couple of years.
So just to be clear, by sending multiple letters to the EU, Boris Johnson has covered his backside, as it were. He's technically in compliance with the Benn Act because he did send the first letter, right? But he sent subsequent letters basically nullifying the first letter. So he did a statutory obligation legally. Well, this arguable.
That sums up his position pretty well. His position is that he's fulfilled all the obligations. But as we reported in previous weeks, he was already talking to Varadkar and all the other EU leaders, making it clear to them that he did not want any kind of extension up until, you know, right up to the present date. So the fact that he wrote that letter, they already knew that it was only him crossing I's and dotting T's, if you'll excuse the way I've put that, in order to fulfil something that an obligation Parliament had put on him. They knew that his position was that he did not want that extension. And in fact, the EU doesn't want the extension either. So it's going to be very interesting to see what happens. If the EU formally refuses the extension, then it puts Parliament in a tricky situation because, of course, they will be left with making a choice between Boris's deal and no deal.
And just quickly, before we move on, Keir Starmer is running point on Labour's effort to put a second amendment attached to, or second referendum attached to, Boris Johnson's Leave Bill. In other words, we'll support Boris Johnson's Leave deal, but as long as there's a second referendum attached to it, and that is a referendum put to the people based on Johnson's deal and also remain in the EU. So it's like, if you don't like Johnson's deal, then you automatically by default are going to select remain in the EU. This is what they've really pushed heavily in the press over the last 48 hours. So that depends whether, do you think there's any legs with that?
I think it's going to be very interesting to see. Now, the reason that Boris's vote failed on Saturday was because of the Oliver Letwin's amendment. But Oliver Letwin made it clear when he introduced that amendment that he would vote for Boris's act this week. So the question is whether those, and all the other rebels and the ERG are also making it clear that they're going to vote for the act this week. So it's looking very like Boris has the numbers in order to get the act passed. But the question is whether any of those people would only vote for that act on the basis that you've just suggested. So that is
a second referendum. Which changes the whole picture once again.
It could do. Really, I think a second referendum would go down very, very badly with the electorate. And I think that the electorate would very much prefer an election rather than a referendum.
But the BBC would love a second referendum.
I think a lot of the mainstream press would love a...
months to pick apart the deal and come up with, like, clause 6, paragraph 3. That's the deal breaker right there.
Yeah.
It's the, whatever. It'll be like the O.J. Simpson trial, but for Brexit. So
I think
it'll become a national obsession.
I think that's quite a good comparison there. It's very like the O.J. Simpson trial, isn't it? But anyway, right, look, if you like what the UK Column does and you would like to support us, then please head over to ukcolumn.org/community. There are options for joining us there, and your support would be very much appreciated. Now, Patrick, Let's get on to arms dealing and Arms Watch.
Well, this is a story, just to reiterate, that we first covered back in September on the 23rd here at the UK Column News. This is a story that broke on a website called Arms Watch, and this was a three-part series which revealed U.S.-procured weapons from Serbia making its way to Islamic State terrorists in Yemen and Syria. And this was a story that got very little mainstream attention, and it centers around this whistleblower, Alexander Obradovic, and he is an employee of Krusik, Serbian arms manufacturer, and he is a whistleblower who provided documents to investigative journalist Diljana Gatanyeva. She's a Bulgarian independent investigative journalist and founder of Arms Watch, and when the Serbian authorities conducted a covert operation to find out where these documents, who leaked these documents, this whistleblower was unmasked and then put in prison just this past, or the week before last. And he was imprisoned, and it, lo and behold, it triggered some public interest in this story that was not expected. We have the journalist on the line, Diljana Gatanyeva. She is in Bulgaria right now, in Sofia, and hopefully we can connect her right now if she's available.
Hello, Diljana.
Hello, thank you for inviting me.
Right, levels are very low.
Okay. Yes, Diljana, if you can just give us a quick summary of how this story started, and just give us a quick synopsis. We've just got some technical difficulties with regards to the call from Diljana in Sofia. So we're going to rejoin her later. We might do a separate segment after this news broadcast, but do stay tuned, and we will also announce that on social media as well.
Okay, well, that's unfortunate, but look, let's move on to this. Patrick, this is the Courier Mail in Australia. And this is their front page for today. Well, as you can see, we've got lots of stuff redacted, it seems. Well, here's the Herald and Sun, the Herald Sun in Australia. And well, that looks pretty much the same front page. Here's NT News in Australia, and the same again. Here's the Daily Telegraph, and the same again. And here's the Australian, and the same again. So they've all decided to run jointly a campaign today, which is basically because, if you remember a couple of months ago, the Australian press, ABC in particular, subject to police raids, and this was on the basis of information that they had published from a whistleblower, and they have decided, the press in Australia has decided, that they're going to run a campaign together in order to try and expose what the government is attempting to do to shut down free speech in the press in Australia. Well, it seems to be that they have set aside any commercial interests here to try to deal with this issue. That's quite a development.
Yes, this we originally saw it when this story broke. This was not long after Julian Assange was bundled out of the Ecuadorian embassy in London. And then incarcerated in Belmarsh prison. And this move by the Australian state, basically for journalists who were exposing things that have already been exposed, very similar to what WikiLeaks exposed, which was the operations and actions of special forces, NATO special forces in Afghanistan. But there was also a desire by the government to want to get their sources and documents and have the right to come into journalists' apartments and download the contents of their laptops, interrogate them, etc., walk into ABC Australia and have access anytime to anything on the premises. Mm. This is what the government is attempting to do in this case. And the journalists involved who are under threat have come out very defiant, some of them in the national press as well. And so the question is Australia going to move with a heavy hand on this, or are they going to back off? And looking at past history, Australia is very compliant to the wishes of the United States in history. So they've even gone so far as to overthrow a Labor MP, Prime Minister, Gough Whitlam, in 1975 at the direction of the CIA. That's fairly well documented event.
It's quite interesting that, of course, when Britain was experiencing its own efforts from the British government to try to deal with free speech in the press, we didn't see this solidarity from the main newspapers. Some of them stuck together, the Mail and a couple of others, but the Guardian, for example, and the Financial Times didn't. It's perhaps a positive thing that the press in Australia sticking together on this issue.
Hopefully yes, but we'll see what comes out of this. But the fact that it's happening is very disturbing.
Right now, United States news then. Hillary
Clinton in a podcast with I think it was called Campaign HQ with the former Obama campaign manager David Plouffe, basically accused Tulsi Gabbard of being a Russian asset. And went on to not just smear Tulsi Gabbard, but also Jill Stein as well. And we have the audio of this. Let's go ahead.
Let's have a listen to this.
Let's play this.
I'm not making any predictions, but I think they've got their eye on somebody who's currently in the Democratic primary and are grooming her to be the third party candidate. Mm-hmm. She's the favorite of the Russians. They have a bunch of sites and bots and other ways of supporting her so far. And that's assuming Jill Stein will give it up, which she might not, because she's also a Russian asset.
That's quite a statement, also a Russian asset. There must be an opportunity for libel there, slander at least.
Well, the fact that this is commonplace now, this sort of rhetoric has been going now for 3 years. And what's interesting is Hillary Clinton has clearly done this as an attack on Tulsi Gabbard, who is a competitor in the Democratic race. She's protecting the top tier candidates, Joe Biden, for instance, maybe Elizabeth Warren, the sort of chosen ones, as it were, of the Democratic National Committee. But the opposite has happened. Instead of getting some kind of a bump in the polls for those top tier candidates, it's actually allowed Tulsi Gabbard to poll vote over quite a few of her competitors, huge amount of support, media attention, a lot of sympathy, even from mainstream media pundits. Even half of CNN's talking heads are basically defending Tulsi as much as you could expect that they would, considering that it's a pro-Clinton network, CNN. But it's worked against Hillary. And this proves the theory that one of the reasons that she lost in 2016 is because she came out straight away at the beginning of the general election campaign and started blaming the Russians for aiding Donald Trump. And that hurt Hillary Clinton's campaign, much the same way she's done here. She's now floated the conspiracy theory that Tulsi Gabbard is a Russian asset, Jill Stein's a Russian asset. It's, again, worked against Hillary Clinton. So it's proof that this talking point doesn't actually resonate really with the Democratic base at all, or with America, full stop.
I mean, you suggest that this is possibly helping Tulsi a little bit. Is she going to gain some ground in the election campaign as a result?
She already has. She's effectively leapt over at least two of her near competitors, and has put her into, I think, comfortably into the top five or six candidates now. And not only that, she's got a lot of people interested in what she's saying. Her message is beginning to resonate. And it also, Hillary Clinton has overestimated her own influence and popularity within politics in America, quite frankly. So again, we have this separate two cultures, the elite Democratic culture, the mainstream media, the DNC, and then you have the American people. And so the problem is the Democratic Party is already divided. There is already a civil war between the Social Democrats of America, the AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the more radical left-wing, the Bernie is kind of on that half as well. So that's already a civil war within the mainstream Democratic Party. Now you add this, another one, potential civil war. This is a battle between the Clintonites and Tulsi Gabbard, which didn't exist before. So further division within the Democratic Party can only benefit Donald Trump in the 2020 election.
Do you think there's any chance that they could pull this together prior to the election?
It's not looking good right now, and Tulsi is going to keep doing what Donald Trump did in 2016, was taking out her competitors one by one. She effectively took Kamala Harris out a couple of months ago in one of the first debates, and Kamala Harris has not recovered since, but is still there in the, quote, top tier and still echoing some of the same Clintonista talking points. Here's one of them. This is Kamala Harris. And it's the Russians. Well, this is what she tweeted out this week. In the last elections, Russians used Facebook to suppress black voter turnout by exploiting our nation's Achilles heel, race. And Facebook's current policy continues to fail to protect our democracy. So she's blaming both the Russians and Facebook for being a threat to U.S. democracy. So I didn't know that the Russians suppressed black voter turnout in the 2016 elections. That was a new one for me. This was new knowledge that has come to the fore thanks to Kamala Harris.
She give any explanation how they did that?
I don't know. She didn't. It's kind of a fact-free analysis, but she's saying that America's Achilles heel is race, and the Russians have exploited it. I'm going to just clarify that a little, fine-tune that statement by Kamala Harris a bit more. I'm going to say that the Democratic Party's Achilles heel is race baiting. Mm. And the race baiting that a lot of Americans, including Democrats, including left-wing Democrats, are just getting tired of the mainline politicians pulling the race card, pulling the gender card, pulling the identity politics cards, full stop. America is absolutely sick of it. And in fact, that is one of the reasons why you have President Donald Trump in the White House. So if they're going to double down on this strategy for campaigning, then they better prepare for a second term of Donald Trump, because this is exactly where it's going to head.
Now, the issue of transgender, the transgender lobby, has absolutely hit the mainstream press over the last couple of days in the UK. It began with this story. Because basically Procter & Gamble has decided to change its branding on some of its products in order to remove the Venus logo from those products. So any hint that it's for women needs to be taken away. And this is following a campaign on Twitter, mainly by a couple of transgender activists, one using the pseudonym Melly Boom, who was tweeting in July, asking them why it was imperative to have the sign for females on their sanitary products. It said, there are non-binary and trans folk who still need to use your products too, you know. So apparently then another activist, Ben Saunders, who was named Young Campaigner of the Year by Stonewall in May, he also got involved, or she, or I guess he, got involved in this campaign. And then as a result of that, Procter & Gamble tweeted back and said, we're glad to inform you that as of December, we will use a wrapper design without the feminine symbol. Well, this has caused a massive furore, Patrick, amongst any women's groups and campaigners on women's issues. They are going mad on that, and equally with this, because you know, we've long said that sport was probably going to become a major front on this battle as well. And here we have Rachel McKinnon, a transgender athlete who has now taken part in another cycling race and won that race. This is
beer gut and all.
Absolutely. Well, she's 37 years old, and clearly, as many people on Twitter are suggesting, didn't make it in men's sport, is making it in women's sport, and women finding this extremely unfair because, transgender or not, this person has a competitive advantage. There's no question about that. But most disturbing of all, I think, over the last couple of days is this story here from The Times, police forces let rapists record their gender as female. And so what the Times are saying here is that six forces, including South Yorkshire and Thames Valley, have disclosed under freedom of information laws that if someone is arrested or convicted of rape, the official record will state the gender they choose to identify themselves as. And again, women's groups and are up in arms about this because, of course, rape is seen very much as a male problem. This is South Yorkshire, Thames Valley, Durham, Kent, Norfolk and Suffolk, as well as British Transport Police are involved in this. A representative from Kent Police said a female may be under investigation for rape or have a conviction for rape that was committed when they had male genitalia. Kent Police currently manages these offenders with convictions for rape who now self-define as female. And the question is, will they be going to a male or a female prison? And I think that under the circumstances, particularly under the circumstances of the offence that they have committed, many women would find that a pretty disturbing proposition.
It all makes perfect sense, doesn't it?
Yes, we probably don't have too much more to say on that. So let's end with this one. This is from Councillor Liam Walker, a Conservative councillor, who has made the point that someone has been replacing David Cameron's book covers in a London shop. Naughty, but pretty hilarious. I actually thought it was quite hilarious because quite an cost to go to do this. Basically, his hardback book is being defaced by replacing the covers with something that highlights his propensity for certain animals and other problems with the schools that he went to and so on. So they've changed the fly cover in order to make a bit of a joke about David Cameron. I think he absolutely deserves it.
So it's a hard cover and they're just changing the book cover on
They're changing the
book
cover on it.
It's a very clever, low-cost way to do disruptive activism.
I think that is, that's why I'm highlighting it. I think it's a great idea. Mm. Although in this case...
I don't think David Cameron thinks it's a great idea.
Well, look, we're going to have to leave it there. I do apologise about the problems with the connection to Sophia with Diliana. I think what we'll try to do, if we can, is to record this afternoon and we'll make it available later on.
Sure, yeah.
Okay, so we'll leave it there for today. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back at the same time on Wednesday. We'll see you then. Bye-bye.